A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging these organizations. We'll look at the impact of the economy, technology, and society on the arts, the importance of arts education, and how these organizations and ensembles are adjusting and innovating as they face the future. Today, we'll check in on the annual New Jersey Symphony Orchestra Edward T. Cohn Composition Institute at Princeton University. We'll hear from the four young composers who are participating this year about their experiences, as well as from the Institute's conductor, David Robertson. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. The National Endowment for the Arts has announced its latest class of jazz masters, which recognizes individuals for their significant contributions to jazz. Among this year's groups of honorees are jazz historian, critic, and Jazz at Lincoln Center co-founder Stanley Crouch, vocalist, composer, arranger, and creator of Schoolhouse Rock, Bob Durow, pianist and composer Abdullah Ibrahim, and composer, arranger, and bandleader Maria Schneider. The honorees will be recognized at the 2019 NEA Jazz Masters Tribute Concert, which will be held next April at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. Opera America will be funding commissioning grants for five female composers, including a project for Opera Philadelphia's O20 season. The $98,000 in funding will support New York-based Beth Morrison projects for the work Adoration by composer Mary Kuyumjian, a Jennifer Higdon opera called Ashes, commissioned by Opera Philadelphia, the opera Lady Murasaki and the Tale of Genji, composed by Michi Wianco, for New York-based On-Site Opera, and two works by Kamala Sankaram, Looking at You at Opera on Tap in New York, and Taking Up Serpents at Washington National Opera. The grants, part of a broader Opera America initiative to support women composers, covers up to 50% of the commissioning fee. Pianist Christopher O'Reilly will not be returning to his host position at the popular weekly NPR program From the Top after the organization declined to renew his contract. In a statement, From the Top, which showcases performances by young musicians, said it was unable to come to an agreement with O'Reilly and that its new approach would add new voices and perspectives to the programs. In his own statement on Facebook, O'Reilly said that From the Top dropped efforts to renew his contract after a series of discussions that sought to reduce the number of shows that he would host as From the Top brought in new guests. O'Reilly will be featured in some upcoming programs that had already been recorded. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. This year's New Jersey Symphony Orchestra Edward T. Cohn Composition Institute is wrapping up with a concert this evening at Princeton University, where four young composers each have had a work read, rehearsed, and now performed by the orchestra. The week-long program provides opportunities to get feedback from musicians, assistance and mentoring from composer, institute director, and Princeton professor Stephen Mackey, and professional development programs such as visits to publisher Boosey & Hawkes and New Music USA. Now in its fifth year, the Institute is a rare opportunity for emerging composers to have a new work performed by a professional orchestra, and a way to hear how their notes on the page translate to the concert stage, such as finding a proper blend in orchestration, dynamics, tempo, and other details. I sat down recently with this year's group, Jonathan Zeiner, Aaron Hendricks, Brian Schenk, and Natalie Diederich, about what brought them to the program and what they gained from the experience.
I'm John Zeiner. I'm a composer from New York City, currently finishing a doctorate at Juilliard. I actually had a friend who did this 2 years ago, Will Stackpole, who I think just like really loved the experience and kind of has been pushing me to apply every year. And finally, I got lucky enough to have been accepted this year, but it was really through him that I kind of became aware of it, really, and saw what the Cohn Institute was doing and what was involved and how great it is.
My name is Aaron Hendricks. I'm a composer and pianist from Houston, Texas. I currently live in Ann Arbor. I finished my master's at Michigan last year. And there's been a number of Michigan composers, friends of mine, Matt Brown, mm-hmm. Jun Wei, James Anderson, who have done this in the past. And all these people have sort of done, you know, some of the festival circuits, but they all just repeatedly talked about this one, said apply to this one, get to this one if you can. They just said it's just a different experience. So that was, you know, just through colleagues of mine that have done the same thing.
My name's Brian Shank. I'm a composer and a percussionist from Saratoga, New York. When I was looking at it, I didn't have any friends that had been through it. And in reading the description, it was we all spend probably a lot of time looking for opportunities to have orchestra pieces performed. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. It's not easy, even if you're at a school, to get an orchestra to play a piece seriously. And then secondly, were the, if you want to call them the extras that go along with this week. Going to New York yesterday and meeting a bunch of publishers and other arts organizations that have opened their arms to help us. Having coachings with Steve Mackey and David Robson, who have both given just like an enormous amount of their time. It's pretty stunningly. Those are the kind of things that, well, you know, obviously make it more appealing than just any kind of any other thing.
My name is Ashley Dietrich, and I am a composer, violinist, and vocalist from Harleysville, Pennsylvania. I first kind of came across this institute as I was doing the search for orchestral opportunities, and as we all do and are familiar with. And so I came across, and similar to Brian, read the description and became interested in the kinds of professional development, the activities that were just kind of instrumental to this institute. It was also Steve Mackey being involved that really attracted me to this, because I know his orchestral work. I think he has a lot to say and a lot to offer to all of us. So in addition to all the other opportunities, I think that was central to my wanting to come to this particular institute.
Well, as certainly the centerpiece is, you each came with a work that you had written and wanted to, you know, work, tweak, and bring to concert. And they all have differing influences. Some are based on your own instrumental or background. Others, you know, from things from your childhood and all the things that just go into making a great, you know, great composition in general. But I wanted to ask if you could each just kind of give us a sense of how the elements that came together to that piece.
Sure. So as a violinist, I've been in orchestras quite a bit for quite a few years. And I really loved being able to absorb the whole repertoire, knowing that I kind of wanted to do something different than what I had heard before and different from also my body of work. So I wanted to do something very slow, spacious, and atmospheric. And the way that I went about constructing the piece was in a few different layers that developed independently of one another. They're in different harmonic worlds, so they kind of have their own timeline of events, their own life and their own arcs to them. And I found it interesting to compose in that way and then also step back and listen to the composite of those sounds and think about when and if those things coalesce, either by chance or by influence from one another.
And your work, it was
Aeolian Dusk.
When I'm writing a piece, I like very much to ground myself with something real before I start it, whether that's extra musical, which in this case it is, or some part of my life that I'm trying to express or depict or something. So this piece is called Into the Rose Garden. It comes from the beginning of T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. And it's not narrative in any exact way, but I like to say that it helped kind of establish a mental space for me to work in. That beginning of it, well, it talks about time, you know, capital T time, and ideas about eternal possibility. It's something he's very interested in an Eastern sense, Eastern philosophical sense. And it's a dream of sorts. So at first I thought it was going to be a depiction almost of what it's like to walk through a garden or a space outdoors where you're going and then you're assailed by a new, you know, sense, smell or sight or something like that. I thought that's what it was going to be like. And I started doing that and I realized it wasn't really working, just too many disparate elements. So instead now the piece has a very clear arc where you have moments where I think like some of the metallic percussion sounds kind of remind us that we're in a dream state. And I mean, we could talk about that for a long time, but there are like little musical elements in here that hold the piece together, you know, and in some ways still communicate the sense that this isn't a real world that we're inhabiting. So that idea grounded it for me.
And Aaron, yours also kind of has this dream element or movement element. Mm-hmm. Tell us how you kind of were inspired to do Night Train.
It was a very vivid memory from my childhood, just of waking in the middle of the night to the sound of trains coming and going, and just hearing them get louder as they approach and fade into the distance. And so as soon as I had at Michigan the opportunity to write a piece with a student orchestra, I knew that's what I wanted to try and capture. One of the biggest challenges actually for me in that is that I decided early on, and I thought it was kind of a risk, but I think it's worked, was that I was going to commit very literally to, or commit to conveying elements of this scene, this story, because there is a very clear narrative I want to convey in my piece. And I decided to convey those elements as literally as possible in the orchestra, and that's something that can get cheesy quickly, I think, if you're not careful. You know, a literal crossing bell, you know, this snare playing a train, and all these things have been done before. That's the other danger. But and then the other thing I had to do was, when I started writing it, it was my first time writing for orchestra, and I was thinking, okay, you know, I've been in school for years now, studying music. I've studied orchestral scores for years now. I've been preparing for this for years. But when I sat down to write for orchestra for the first time, when I started that process, it was like, it was just a blank slate. Like everything, every orchestra score that I looked at before that was just gone. I had nothing to pull from. And so, because it's just different looking at a score, knowing that you're going to be doing that. It's not this hypothetical, like someday in 1,000 years, maybe I'll write for orchestra. Like, this is happening now. And so the first thing I do is go find pieces that kind of inhabited the sound world I wanted. And I knew what that sound world was in my brain somewhere. I just didn't know what pieces it were. But then I found sort of a body of works that like did what I wanted to do, and I stole like crazy and started writing.
Resonant bells stemmed, I think, a lot from me turning on the television every day and seeing something that just kind of bothered me, whether it was, you know, I don't know, just uneasiness, I think, in current events, global events, and I needed to kind of write this piece, and it needed to be dark and brooding and kind of angsty, which is a little bit different from what I normally like to do, I think. But the bell idea wasn't really something I necessarily started with. It was something that came kind of halfway through. The piece was, you know, kind of already, at first it was in 3 short movements, then I thought maybe 2 movements. It was kind of a work in progress and was morphing different sizes and shapes. But when I found the bell inspiration, it was through Edgar Allan Poe's The Bells. And when I was reading the poetry, I kind of felt like I was reading the music that I was writing, and sort of decided to then compact all of these ideas that I had into a single movement and also unite them with this idea of warning bells, or something being, you know, these bells being harbingers of something bad that was going to come, or something to that sort of prophetic aspect of bells.
Mm-hmm. So you arrive here with your pieces, you go, you have master classes, you have your first rehearsal, then you have feedback and talk back from the musicians. Talk a bit about what this process has been like in terms of hearing your piece in this context for the first time, what people have been saying, and how you've approached it maybe a little bit differently.
So I had this piece read already, actually, by the Juilliard Orchestra. So I've already been able to kind of hear some of the mistakes that I made the first time around, and was able to revise the piece before I got here. That being said, once I got here, there were even more mistakes that I made that we were able to kind of thankfully go back during this whole process and amend some of our mistakes. There's a passage towards the end of the piece that is the big kind of triumphant climax of the work, but I overscored it. There's way too much stuff going on. I got a little maybe overzealous or something, but I was able to kind of, you know, scale back some dynamic markings and actually remove music from the score and then resubmit a new section to Maestro Robertson and the musicians. And later today, I'll see if hopefully those changes come out well.
I had also had a performance of a version of this piece while I was at school, and tremendous learning experience there. So the first thing I did when I found out I got into the Cohen Institute, though, because I knew from my first performance, I knew what had gone well, but I knew the many, many things that had gone very poorly. So the first thing I did was, I made a plan. I spent probably 100 hours between, you know, when I got accepted and when I sent in the final score, making revisions. Because these are big things. These are big structural issues. These are extended passages that needed just complete reorchestration. What that allowed us when we got here at a much cleaner piece, and we got to start talking detail. And in my first lesson, the first meeting with Maestro Robertson before first rehearsal, we jumped into score, and he started, he pointed out something to me, like a detail thing. And I could have studied my own score for 100 years, and I would never have caught this thing. My brain doesn't work that way. I don't have an eye for it. It makes sense as soon as he points it out. And there were just a number of things like that, that just really fine-tuning stuff that is going to make a big difference, I think. It's not, you know, it looks like a fine-tuning. It's small because it's a couple notes here and there, but it can have a much, much more profound effect, I think, in cleaning up the way an idea conveys. And so a number of those things, and just, you know, rebalancing dynamics in passages at his suggestions and at Steve Mackey's suggestions. And so that was a majority of my time, is just really, really rebalancing dynamics and adjusting these things that were just like little elements that were fighting each other and now they're not.
I'm the black sheep here. I have not had a reading of this piece. It was the first time I had heard it on Tuesday. It was emotional. It didn't sound the way I thought it was going to sound at first. Not because of anything the players were doing, but because of what I had written on the page. It's like when you read a poem to yourself and actually speak it out loud. I mean, they're completely different things. So, yeah, I mean, as Aaron alluded to, we all had about a half an hour with Maestro, and he said, maybe don't do that, you know, here. And, like, you've got some things you can change here. And maybe one of the most interesting things we did this week was have him reorchestrate it kind of on the spot. And, like, he almost did that in everyone's piece to some degree.
Yes.
He would just say, all right, strings, you're going to lay out here for these bars, or you're going to just play the accented notes, he would do something. He'd tweak something. He'd take something out and give it to another instrument. And it was a revelation every time he did something like that. Holy cow, you know what I mean? You could really make this into something really special. It's already good, but it can be really special. And so we had about a full day to do all the revisions that we wanted. That was pretty intense for me. I imagine it's the same for everybody else, too.
I'm in the fortunate position to have had a wonderful performance of this piece before coming here, and also a reading by the Albany Symphony. And I got to take a lot of experience from Albany into how I approached the changes that I made this week. Some of them, we were sitting down on the first day with Steve Mackey, and he would point something out and say, this third here, this in the low register, you know, I'm not sure if this will quite speak. And it's it's this level of detail that sets apart something that's a good, solid orchestra piece and one that's very well-crafted and polished. So I think between his comments and also the comments from Maestro, there were just a lot of detail and directional comments, more so than note changes, to really add some polish to the piece.
Well, as most of you noted, part of this week was not just working on the music itself, but also the tours, the visits, the networking side of it. What one or two elements have you found this past week that were either really eye-opening or really gave you a new perspective or you really feel is exactly what you needed?
Yesterday we were in New York. We went to two places in particular. We went to Boozy and Hawks, and we went to a place called New Music USA. Mm-hmm. And the overall effect of both of those was to make things seem career-wise, interpersonally, seem approachable and tangible. We were kind of just talking about this beforehand, how the pros and cons of being in an institution, actually. I have not been in a school for the last 3 years, and I was saying, well, yeah, it's a lot cheaper, but you're by yourself every day, pretty much. And unless you make a huge effort to interact with people, you're going to be by yourself a lot of the time. Or, you know, you have 14 roommates. You know.
That's the other option.
That's the other option.
You force it upon yourself.
At New Music USA, they wanted us more than anything to leave knowing that it wasn't just a place to go and get grant money. It is a community of people who are there to help you in every single aspect of your career, of your work, and I had no idea that was there. At Boozy, one of the big things we talked about was, it was kind of a practical talk about your career. You know, obviously things like network, you know, be nice to everyone you meet. Okay, that's good. It's good to hear that said, you know, but they were saying also things like, well, if you have your, we all have grand ideas somewhere hidden. If you have a piece you want to write, and it's for two orchestras and like seven choirs, maybe at this point in your career, it's not the right thing to be writing. Maybe you should think about what can actually be feasibly played by any number of ensembles in, as John was saying, the amount of time that is naturally given to those groups in order to best propel you forward and give yourself, you know, set yourself up to have opportunities. So that was really, yeah, just a good reminder. It's not like blowing open any doors that, you know, we hadn't thought of before, but it's nice to hear that from people in those kinds of positions.
We had a great score preparation session, and it was, you know, it was focused a bit more on the Sibelius side as a notation software, as opposed to Finale, the other. There's, you know, kind of two camps, but we really got down to the nuts and bolts of some of the practical things and also the time saving things on our end, so we can, as Brian said, focus more on the music. You know, if we have our settings set up a certain way in the program, that can save us hours of time just trying to adjust things. And if that's, you know, if that's two more hours of time that we have to focus on orchestrational detail or just making things clear in other aspects to performers, that is time well spent and worthwhile. And to get such great advice from someone who's been through that, who's done the engraving process of fixing up scores and getting them ready to put in front of performers, he's thought of all the aspects of this. So I think that was helpful for all of us to think about setting ourselves up right at the beginning, at the start, so we can be more efficient going forward.
I don't know what to say. It's just the whole thing has been eye-opening, I think. I've been around orchestras, but I've never worked with orchestras, so seeing it really from that side is awesome. And really, you know, it feels special to be actually, instead of kind of rooting on your friends in the orchestra or, you know, sitting back and kind of enjoying it, there's like some, you know, there's some anxiety. Like, you're working with them. You want to make them happy. All of that stuff, I think, is new for me and has been eye-opening for me, as well as all of the things we've been doing on the side, which they don't really feel like they've been on the side. I mean, they've been kind of at the forefront of the week as well.
That was my conversation with Jonathan Zeiner, Brian Shank, Aaron Hendricks, and Natalie Diederich, the four composers participating in this year's NJSO Edward T. Cohn Composition Institute at Princeton University. That was my conversation with Jonathan Zeiner, Brian Shank, Aaron Hendricks, and Natalie Diederich, the four composers participating in this year's NJSO Edward T. Cohn Composition Institute at Princeton University. Maestro David Robertson returned for a second time this year to lead the orchestra. Robertson this year wrapped up his tenure as music director of the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra, and he's also chief conductor and artistic director of the Sydney Symphony Orchestra. He enjoys leading the orchestra in reading through these works and working with the composers because of the ways in which it can develop the composer's perspectives and career.
It's extremely important because it's very hard to write for orchestra. You have to do a lot of imagining in your head, and then the parts are all worked out, and so everything is, in a sense, fixed in stone. It's almost as though you were a sculptor, and you do everything in your head and send out instructions, but you only see the finished sculpture right before it's going to be unveiled for the public. And that's a very daunting idea, almost like sculpting in the dark, in a sense. And it's only when the light turns on that you see, wait a minute, that's not exactly how I wanted the elbow to look. So the situation here is that the composers can take that imagination, hear it compared to the actual reality of the various instruments presenting the tones that they've put down in the score, and then they have the possibility of seeing how to play around with things and have it sound more like they might really have wanted it but didn't necessarily realize it the first time. That's sadly far too lacking in the musical profession, and it's one of the reasons that people say, well, there aren't very many good orchestral composers. Well, there aren't very many opportunities for composers to develop that without, you know, being in a situation where they're thrown into the deep end and then told to be Olympic swimmers.
And what have you found in this group? Anything that particular with the music that you've been working with?
There are four really contrasted composers. So, for example, the sound that you have out of someone like Brian Jenk is completely different than you would have with Natalie Dietrich. And that's one of the things that's really nice, is that you're not trying to get everyone to sound the same by any means. What you're trying to do is help them find out what it is that they would like to realize and how that can be realized in the best way. And that's really the object of it. I think all four composers have something, you know, really fascinating to show. The thing we like with composers is that they show a personality, or they demonstrate a personality that is unique. And yet, in order to get that sense of uniqueness, they need to know how to handle an orchestra in such a way that their ideas come forth rather than it just being something that they know will work because they've read it in an orchestration book. The sounds that they would like to create need to be the sounds that they want to create and not ones that they're just simply reproducing.
That was conductor David Robertson, who is conducting the NJSO as part of its Cohen Composition Institute. More details on the institute can be found at njsymphony.org/Cohen. You can also hear my full conversation with the composers on the A Tempo page of our website at wwfm.org. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you each week on A Tempo that focus on the changing dynamics and challenges in the arts world. But remember that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.